When the Ballymascanlan Interchurch Talks were set up in 1973, which was the first major ecumenical initiative in Ireland, working parties were set up on various topics, including interchurch marriages, and Donal served on that. And so through that, he learned a great deal more about maybe how the Roman Catholic side saw the issue. When the Interchurch Committee reported in 1975, the result of it was the setting up of a standing committee to look at practical problems that arose in interchurch marriages. Now, I think that leaders like Donald recognised that the Catholic Church in Ireland couldn't really make unique exceptions just for the particular circumstances of this island. They were bound into universal church teaching. So the scope there was somewhat limited, necessarily. They weren't a national church like the Church of Ireland, able to formulate in large measure its own doctrine. So I think he recognised that. The situation regarding interchurch marriages evolved over a number of years, but Donald, around the time of the Ballymascanlan Committee, was disconcerted to find that the Roman Catholic hierarchy in Ireland, or the bishops, individual bishops, it differed from diocese to diocese. John Charles McQuaid, for instance, in Dublin, had a fairly strict view of the proceedings, and that's something that's brought out very well in Leslie Whiteside's biography of George Otto Sims. But there were differences in Ireland then between the practice in England and Wales on the Roman Catholic side, and a new directory brought out in 1983 somewhat more regularised that position. Progress was incremental and it evolved gradually until, by the 1990s, couples were largely making up their minds on the matter themselves. But always the Church of Ireland community, through its representatives in these committees, remained concerned at this unjust promise. They said it violated the conscientious obligations of each partner and wasn't conducive to good intermarital relations. The issue of friendships maintained across the ecumenical sphere with people like Cardinal Tomaso Fee, there's a great Irish language common interest there. And Donald, I think, took people as he found them and didn't attach to them or see them as ciphers of a whole baggage of religious, political and social opinions. He related to them as people, and he had many interests with which to form friendships with the particular people that are notable. For instance, in relation to Cardinal O'Fee, the Gaelic language interests. O'Fee was a renowned Gaelic scholar, and few people moving in the Irish language firmament would have been unaware of his extensive scholarship in that regard. And he used to host Irish-speaking nights in Ora Chéile in Armagh, and Walton Empey would go along to these. They were for Gaelic-speaking friends and ecumenical friends generally. And he greatly enjoyed. The Cardinal had a very warm and open personality. He wasn't a remote, austere type of figure that we sometimes associate with Roman Catholic bishops, perhaps unfairly.
And were there others?
Yeah, he had the great interest in philosophy in common with Desmond Connell, who was Archbishop of Dublin from 1988 and who later became Cardinal, of course, after Donald had retired, that is. Connell was an expert on Malebranche, the famous 18th century French philosopher, someone who George Berkeley also knew, and Berkeley, of course, was someone who Donald greatly admired.
George Berkeley.
The Bishop of Cloyne, famous philosopher. Donald won a prize in Berkeley in philosophy while a student in Trinity College. Similarly, Cardinal Cahill Daly, who was a philosopher of some note, Donald was obviously aware of those interests, and they formed excellent common ground with which to have conversations on the many occasions in which these leaders would meet.
So Angus, as between his interest in involvement and study of the Irish language and philosophy, Bishop Caird found himself with a whole range of colleagues, if you like, within the Catholic Church.
That's right. He had common ground from the word go. So when he met these people socially, like Cardinal O'Fee, he had the Irish language interest to draw on. Philosophy with Cardinal Desmond Cullen, Archbishop and later Cardinal, and with Cahill Daly, who succeeded Cardinal O'Fee after he died. Also with Bishop Kevin McNamara. McNamara came to Dublin before Donald Caird, and they enjoyed a very warm friendship, which didn't last too long because, unfortunately, Kevin McNamara died from cancer very soon into his period of office.
Later came the issue of the ordination of women, and in your book you describe Bishop Caird as a traditionalist and one who was opposed to the ordination of women. And yet he became the first Church of Ireland bishop to ordain a woman. Mm-hmm. How do you square that circle?
Donald Caird was a traditionalist. It's not that he formed the view that there was an inherent unacceptability in women by virtue of their gender in relation to becoming priests, which would be something of the Roman Catholic view, that they were that the priest acts in persona Christi in celebrating the sacraments, and therefore a woman couldn't step into that role. And Donald wasn't basing his resistance to women's ordination on that, but with an eye to the Orthodox and Roman Catholic and ecumenical context, the other great churches of Christendom, far greater in number than the Church of Ireland, hadn't taken this step, and he felt it was something that shouldn't be addressed until the churches together could form a common mind on it. The diaconate was a slightly different issue, because he pointed to Scripture and St. Paul's references to Phoebe, the deacon, not the deaconess, as one of the leading figures in the church there. So he was concerned. His argument was rooted in breaking Catholic tradition, and he made his famous speech in 1989 to the General Synod, likening the Church of Ireland in taking such a step to a herd of lemmings jumping over a cliff. And what he meant by that, and the warning he sounded, was that the Church of England was only still discussing the matter of ordination of women at this time, hadn't actually enacted legislation, and if the Church of Ireland voted for it, they might find themselves in a situation where their ministers were not licensed to celebrate sacraments in parts of England because of this change. Certainly the women ministers wouldn't be. But he was a loyal son of the church, and when the General Synod passed the bill allowing the legislation to be brought forward, he fully accepted the decision, and in fact that following October, so the final decision of the Synod was in May 1990, and in October he ordained the Reverend Ginny Kennerly.
So in the end he went along with the flow of things.
He did, and his view evolved. It was incremental, and I think even seeing women in operation in his diocese, such as Ginny Kennerly and subsequently Gillian Wharton, and their very effective ministry.
Gillian Wharton,
the Reverend Gillian Wharton, yes, who was a curate in Glenageary, who was appointed under Gordon Linney, his archdeacon. When he saw their very effective ministry in operation, this changed his own thinking. But it was evolutionary and incremental.
During the period 1983, pro-life when he was Bishop of Meath, and then later for the divorce referendums, during a period of great tension in Ireland over sexual politics, if you like, how did Donald Caird steer his church in the Republic through these minefields?
Well, as a member of the House of Bishops, Donald was involved in all of these debates from 1983, the first pro-life amendment onwards. The Archbishop of Dublin is traditionally the prime spokesperson of the Church for matters concerning the Republic, the Archbishop of Armagh for matters concerning the state of Northern Ireland, even though there's overlapping of jurisdictions in their provincial responsibilities. And the House of Bishops would have discussed these issues in some detail. Donald came to the fore when he arrived in Dublin, and it coincided with the first referendum on divorce. And he did speak in relation to it. He was criticised in some quarters for not speaking out perhaps more strongly, but he was a traditionalist, as we've discussed already, and he privately regretted the necessity for introducing divorce, but he saw it as a matter of civil rights. So it was not something perhaps that Christians, as he understood their duty as Christians to be, bodies of Christians might choose for themselves, but the state could not lay down a uniform law when there was no consensus across society.
He regarded contraception as an inalienable right. How did that square with his co-religionists?
This was a matter in which thinking had evolved on the Anglican side over previous decades. One of the Lambeth conferences had set out the inalienable right of parties to a marriage to plan their families, taking into account economic and other circumstances. And that would have been the mind of the Church of Ireland also. So when you had things like Charles Haughey's Irish Solution to an Irish Problem, and parents able only to get contraceptives on prescription, this would have been seen as an intrusion into the conscientious deliberations of parties to a marriage, something that's anathema. Conscience was the watchword, I suppose, in terms of the Church of Ireland contributions to these debates. And where there was no consensus across society, the state should not enforce the ethos of one or teaching of one particular denomination. So we see that reflected in relation to abortion. The Anglicans are opposed to abortion, as Roman Catholics are, but acknowledge that there are certain circumstances in which a termination may be justified where there's a threat to the life of the mother, for instance, and that is set out in the classical position of the Lambeth Conference. And Donald, and the warnings were sounded in 1983 when the wording was agreed by the government in relation to the mother's health being a balancing factor in recognising the right to life of the unborn. And in fact, Archbishops Armstrong and McAdoo both had some involvement around the margins of the preparation of that wording. This didn't mean that they endorsed the wording, though it was interpreted not unreasonably by some politicians afterwards that the Church of Ireland had given its blessing to the wording. In fact, the only body entitled to make that decision was the General Synod, the Select Committee, and they did not purport to advise people how to vote, but they expressed grave reservations in the debate. The matter evolved, and we saw in 1992 with the X case that in fact some of these warnings came to fruition.
Yeah.
And Donald appealed at that time, when he was in Dublin at this stage, for legislation to set out the parameters in which the Supreme Court's decision in relation to threats to the woman's life and health could be set out, rather than going for another divisive referendum as he saw it at the time.
During this whole period, people like Donald Caird and Victor Griffin, the Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral, came to be seen in the, especially in the media, in the Republic, as being beacons of liberalism, mm-hmm. Against something that was the opposite. How did that play back to Donald Caird?
There was irritation. I reflected that in the book on the side of some a number of Church of Ireland representatives, at this tendency of the media, I suppose, to cast up, to highlight Church of Ireland viewpoints on these issues as a foil to the more reactionary views, as they might have been portrayed, of the Roman Catholic Church.
And that's not the way that he wanted to be.
That is not the way that the Church of Ireland position. They set out fairly detailed statements from the House of Bishops, emphasising in relation to divorce their teaching that marriage was a lifelong union, emphasising in relation to abortion that it was regarded as infanticide and abortion was a heinous crime, but then setting out the exceptions. But of course it was more the exceptions that were highlighted in the sound bites picked up from the media, and also some irritation perhaps at liberal Catholics pointing to the Church of Ireland when arguing for more liberalisation of legislation. As Donald said, they should state their own position, not set us up.
That's right.
Because the resulting impression created in the public mind was that the Church of Ireland's doctrines were just concerned with liberalism, whereas the full gamut of life was covered in its pronouncements.
Well, there were comments at the time, indeed, that the irony, as it was seen, the irony of the champion of liberal Catholics being Protestants.
Yes. There was also some criticism of the fact that perhaps, again, this goes back to Donald's encouraging of Church of Ireland people to get involved in public life, that some of the running was left to liberal Catholics, such people like Mary Robinson and Garrett Fitzgerald, and some surprise was expressed that more Protestants didn't actually voice public support for the constitutional crusade announced by Fitzgerald in his government, which left office in 1987. That there was an absence of perhaps mucking into national debate on the Protestant side in relation to that, something bemoaned again by Donald.